We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots and lots to cover today.
Yes.
Busy week. Including
a new feature, which will be rolling out shortly.
A weekly feature, which will continue to, anyway. Well, you have much to look forward to,
that's right,
dear
so
listener.
Don't move. Starting out locally with the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Yeah, this week the DEA sent letters to 23 medical marijuana dispensaries in Seattle, telling them that they need to shut down or expect to get raided and possibly their property seized. And that includes the buildings that the dispensaries are in. And so, of course, the letters were also sent to the landlords of these medical marijuana dispensaries. And, of course, the issue is not so much that they're selling medical marijuana, which is legal in the state of Washington, but the issue is this, that these 23 pot shops are within 1,000 feet of, quote, an educational facility or other prohibited area, end quote. And if you're thinking that's a little vague, then I'm with you on that one. Other prohibited area could be just about anything you define it to be.
Although a lot of them actually did set up space within 1,000 feet of a school, of an actual school, and were stupid about it. So, and because they were stupid about it, they've left the door open for this kind of harassment to come in.
Yeah, and to be fair, the city of Seattle hasn't set any particular zoning rules about medical marijuana dispensaries. The city council has set to debate that this fall. And in the meantime, the voters will be voting on I-502, which requires medical marijuana dispensaries to be outside 1,000 feet of such zones. Now, it can be pretty hard, though, to know exactly where safe zone is in Seattle, because Seattle is a fairly densely populated city. It's not spread out as much as people might think. And you might also ask, as I did when I saw this news story, since medical marijuana shops require a prescription in order to sell the drug, and those that haven't done that have been shut down, raided and shut down. In fact, a couple of people who were charged with running a medical marijuana dispensary that sold marijuana openly were sentenced this week. You might ask yourself, well, why does it matter whether they're inside a 1,000-foot zone from a school?
And the net effect of this, setting aside the issue of the actual enforcement of the law, is that it is a chilling effect on medical marijuana enterprises that want to open up, because they're having a very hard time finding landlords who will rent to them, because landlords are afraid of exactly this kind of harassment from the federal government, are afraid of having their property seized, whether they're compliant with the law or not. And, of course, a lot of landlords and their attorneys and whatnot aren't familiar with the law, because the law is so vague. So it's very much a chilling effect on medical marijuana in general, whether people are compliant with the law or not.
Yeah. This is fallout, really, from Governor Gregoire not signing the bill that passed the legislature that would have set some kind of standards for the state of Washington and how medical marijuana dispensaries would be regulated.
All right. Moving along, the Department of Justice and the SPD reached a deal, it sounds like.
Well, no, they reached a deal a few weeks ago, but U.S. District Judge James Robard yesterday approved their deal, but he did modify it some also. This is the deal that avoided a lawsuit from the DOJ against the city of Seattle because of the excessive force and discriminatory practices of SPD. Judge Robard modified it to give his court greater oversight in the appointment of the monitor that the deal specifies, monitor the progress of the city in complying with the DOJ's request to reform the department, essentially top to bottom. The judge also wanted information on progress on the deal and specific metrics on that progress, because for some reason, particularly given the history of the city's bad faith in negotiating this deal all the way up until the point where they had to or face a lawsuit within days, for some reason doesn't seem to trust the city. Now, we've got the police union, the Seattle Police Officers Guild, still saying that this deal cannot be implemented because some of the aspects of it need to be negotiated with them. That's likely to be litigated as well. And the other thing at this point is that they now have 60 days after the judge's approval yesterday for the two sides to agree on who that monitor will be, and then SPD will additionally name a compliance coordinator to liaison between the monitor and the SPD and the Department of Justice. So there's still some key decisions that need to be made in terms of who these people will be and whether they will genuinely be able to operate independently.
All right. Moving along, complaint this week against Tim Iman.
Yeah, a woman named Sherry Bockwinkle, who literally started the paid signature gathering industry in Washington State, has a long history of working with initiative campaigns. She filed a PDC complaint this week against Tim Iman. Iman is trying to gather signatures right now for two different initiatives for the November ballot. One of them, I-1185, is the more well-known one. This is yet another Iman initiative that would require two-thirds approval for tax or fee increases in the legislature. He has to try and get one of these passed every 2 years because the legislature can modify initiatives with a majority vote after 2 years. And every time they repeal his initiatives because they're a terrible idea for any kind of governance. But Iman also has another initiative this year, a very poorly worded thing called I-517, which would expand by 6 months the time allowed for gathering signatures for initiative, and also ban decline to sign and other efforts that would actually politically oppose signature gathering efforts, which is, you know, a gross violation of the First Amendment, among other things.
Hard to understand how that could even be legal.
But I-517, he's been gathering signatures for that particular initiative campaign since April, and according to Bockwinkle, Iman has not filed any expenses or income for actually running that campaign, but she's got quite a bit of evidence that he has in fact by being paying people for it, apparently out of the I-1185 campaign. So he's running two campaigns out of one pot of money, and that
is
huge no-no.
Yeah.
So once again, Tom Iman playing around with laws while he tries to make other laws, apparently.
Rising rents.
Yeah, this week Zillow, the Seattle-based real estate website, reported that rents nationwide are going up. In July, the United States saw a year-over-year increase of 5.4% in average rents to $1,278 per month. That's the national average. The Seattle average, of course, is much, much higher. Its year-over-year increase was 4.4% and it's now, the average is $1,679 per month, average rent in the city of Seattle. Now, you might ask, how can that be? People who own their own homes and who I've talked to recently, they've just been astounded at the amount of rent people have to pay just for a one-bedroom apartment here in the city of Seattle. Well, folks, you know, you can in part blame, well, actually, you can mostly blame the housing bubble. With high foreclosure rates, that means lots and lots of people are now looking for a place to rent. And lack of apartment stock, because during the building boom, big construction companies and real estate companies overbuilt condos and did not build any new apartment stock. And then during that boom, at the same time, a lot of older buildings that had formerly been affordable apartments were fixed up and converted into condos or into co-ops. That's left a severe shortage of apartment stock. And of course, in the last 4 years since the bubble burst, there's been almost no building activity at all. It's just now this year starting to gear up again building apartments. Those apartments, of course, won't come online and be available for at least another year or two. And when they do become available, they will be brand new market rate. And if you were listening to us last week, you got an earful of what market rate means. Apartments, which of course are not going to make rent any more affordable for people in the city of Seattle.
And on over to Hanford Nuclear Reservation, it appears they have another leak.
Yeah, another radioactive leak at Hanford, this time in a double-walled tank, which was meant to last at least another 40 years. folks discovered a 3-foot-long mound of radioactive material between the two walls of a stainless steel tank. This tank is one of 28 tanks that were meant to replace the old single-walled tanks that have leaked something more than about 1 million gallons of waste into the surrounding soil and possibly, I think, almost certainly into the nearby river. So I just wanted to point out to folks that, of course, even though these solutions come up and everyone thinks, well, we got it covered for the next 100 years, that no, indeed, nuclear is not clean energy, regardless of what the Republicans want you to think.
All right. Cheryl Chow.
Yeah, the former Seattle City Council member and school board member and a longtime civic activist in Seattle is dying of brain cancer, unfortunately. She's 66 years old, and she came out this week as gay and said several interesting things in the process of coming out. What are you going to do, kill me? Is literally what she said, and that she felt like she'd wasted the last 60 years because she hadn't been able to be public about who she was. Kudos for her for coming out now and actually doing it publicly. And hopefully it will be a reminder that even in a liberal and tolerant and inclusive place like Seattle, there's a lot of people, particularly in sort of specific communities, in Cheryl's case, the Asian American community, where it is still really a stigma to be gay and where there's a lot of difficulty in coming out and publicly being who you are.
And with also with her background in education, there are a lot of people who still believe that gay people should not be involved in any way in educating young people. And this obviously proves the fact that Cheryl Chow was so popular as an educator. This obviously proves that is not true.
Yeah, and just thinking back how much of a role model she could have been over the last, 20, 30 years in her role as a principal, as a school board member, as so forth, for teens and people questioning their own sexuality as they're growing up, if she had felt comfortable doing that herself.
Yes.
And that,
mm-hmm.
that was a tremendous lost opportunity, not only for her personally, but also for the city.
All right. And Kashama Sawant.
Yeah, the socialist candidate who is running against Jamie Peterson for the state legislature in the primary and made it through to the general election, but also made it through in the general election as a write-in candidate against Frank Chopp in the other 43rd district representative race, because the stranger endorsed her in both races. And so she decided this week to run against Chopp, the House Majority Leader, the Democrat, rather than Peterson. So Frank Chopp will have, she's still not likely to win. Chopp got something like 85%+ of the vote. But the fact that Sawant, as a write-in candidate, was able to beat out the person who was actually on the ballot running against Chopp tells you a lot about how much frustration there is with both of the 43rd district representatives, given that it's one of the most liberal districts in the state, and you have two of the more conservative Democrats in the state representing it in the House. So good for her. And she's very, very sharp and very, very articulate, and I really hope she does well in November.
All right, on to national and new weekly segment, sounds like.
Yeah, well, in this show, and, we've been doing this segment for the last 30-minute thing for the last 16 years or so, and we try to be very factually based, back up what we say and deal with reality. And it's come to our attention that there's an awful lot of the political universe out there that really isn't covered by that kind of coverage. And so at least between now and November, we're going to start a weekly segment called This Week in the Alternative in the Alternate Universe.
Yes, Alternate Universe.
Our headliner, of course, this week is Representative Todd Akin, who of Missouri, who managed in one sentence to hit a twofer of not only distinguishing between legitimate and illegitimate rape, but also managing through the magic of lady parts to impart women with the ability to repel sperm that they don't particularly want.
If
it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to shut the whole thing down. One sentence. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's also so clueless that you have to ask yourself, has this guy been living on Mars?
And this is a man.
And this is a man
that the Republicans put on the House Science and Technology Committee.
Yes, and I just want to point out too that if there was any even a tiny grain of truth to what he said, then women wouldn't have to take birth control. But what really
and he wouldn't have any kids.
And what really flabbergasted me was essentially the message that he's sending to clueless and brutal men, and we know that there are plenty of them out there who probably agree with him and think, oh yeah, if I just beat the heck out of her, she won't get pregnant.
Yeah, the really remarkable thing about this, and of course it set off a whole brouhaha within the presidential race and within the Republican Party as Republicans across the country sought to distance themselves from what was, you know, clearly a divorced from reality kind of statement. The problem is that they couldn't do it because just about every Republican in the House, most of them in the Senate, and a lot of different Republican legislators around the country have signed off on banning abortion, even in case of rape, even in case of incest,
yes,
even in case where the mother's health is threatened. And a lot of the people on the Christianist right already believe this stuff. This is in the mainstream of the Republican Party.
And to emphasize that, the Republican Platform Committee this week at the Republican National Convention added it to the party platform.
No, they did. They didn't add it. It's been in the party platform every year since 92.
Yes, each year they vote on what to include in the party platform, and this year they voted to include that.
Again,
at exactly the same time that Aiken was being condemned by his own cohorts in the Republican Party for making that same statement. Ryan subscribes to that philosophy.
Yeah, I want to talk about Ryan for a second, because Ryan and Aiken have been the co-sponsors for all of the most radical anti-abortion legislation in the House.
They have been.
Including a variation of the legitimate rape meme, which is trying to distinguish between something called forcible rape as being an exception for abortion, as though, for example, the whole idea of statutory rape not counting as forcible rape, because they don't get the concept of what consent means.
Right. They don't understand that most rape is not what they term forcible rape, which they mean is violent rape. Most rape is coercive or opportunistic. So, for example, a date saying, okay, let me buy you a drink, and then bringing you a drink that has four shots of booze in it instead of the one that you're used to, and then taking advantage of you later, that's opportunistic or coercive, and that's what a lot of rape looks like these days. And
or even somebody who doesn't resist because they're scared.
That's fair game. Yeah.
You know, as opposed to somebody who, is being physically held down.
Mm-hmm.
It really is clueless. And the real takeaway from this is that in all of these statements, there was more concern expressed for a zygote than there was for the actual victim of an extremely violent crime.
Yes.
The women involved in this entire equation, according to these guys, basically do not exist. And it is the same kind of dynamic that we see with gays, with immigrants, with, you know, all of these other sectors of the public, which add up to a vast majority of the public that, don't look like straight Christian white men. It really is discouraging. So anyway, so that was
just to kind of counter that a little bit, I want to give a couple facts here that according to the best studies of rape, about 5% of women who are raped do get pregnant. And with the CDC saying that total rapes in the United States each year are about 1.3 million women, that's about 65,000 pregnancies, although it could be a little bit less than that because the CDC statistics include some types of rape that the Republicans also don't recognize, namely those that include a male victim.
Actually, also, there's likely to be quite a bit more because a lot of rapes are not reported.
Yes, and a lot of rapes are not reported, so we don't always know. The CDC tried to adjust their statistics for that, however, but they admitted as much that they could not accurately estimate because underreporting is such a big problem.
So that was one piece of our alternate universe, but wait, there's more. We had yesterday Mitt Romney, presidential candidate, joking that, quote, nobody's ever asked to see my birth certificate, which the shorter version of that is, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white.
And he said that proudly, not ironically.
Yeah, he wasn't joking. He was saying it that this qualifies me to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
It was really discouraging. We also had the phenomenon.
Disgusting.
Yeah, well, there's that too. We also had the phenomenon of a guy in Texas, Lubbock County Judge and County Commissioner Tom Head, finally giving the rationale for why Republicans might be willing to raise taxes. They're not willing to raise taxes for bank-busting wars or global depression or huge deficits or critical infrastructure needs, but they will support, in this case, a 1.7% tax increase, which Head endorsed, to cover civil war. Or the cost of civil war against the United States. Oh, and let's throw in sedition and advocating assassination of the President of the United States as well. Quote, Lubbock County has to be prepared for contingencies because, quote, Obama's going to try to hand over the sovereignty of the U.S. to United Nations, and what is going to happen is when that happens. I'm thinking the worst. Civil unrest, civil disobedience, civil war maybe, and we're not just talking a few riots here and demonstrations. We're talking Lexington, Concord, take up arms and get rid is the guy. Now, this is an elected official who should be getting a visit from the Secret Service because the take up arms and get rid of the President of the United States seems to be pretty unambiguous. The problem is, of course, that the Secret Service is awfully busy because he's not the only elected Republican official who talks that way.
Yes, who's saying those things.
And then finally, in our alternate universe this week, we had good news out of Ohio. Ohio ending its plan to extend early voting hours in November for Republican-leaning districts and curtailed early voting hours for Democratic-leaning districts, that because of a public outcry. The bad news, however, is in Franklin County, Ohio, which is where the city of Columbus is located, a guy named Doug Priest, the Republican county chair and who is also sitting on the Electoral Board of Elections, saying, I actually feel that we shouldn't contort the voting process to accommodate the urban Reed African American voter turnout machines. Let's be fair and reasonable. So he was one of the Board of Elections members who blocked efforts to expand voting hours, calling the claims of unfairness, well, actually, I can't say that on the radio, but it's a synonym for cow fecal matter, quote me. So here we have a guy saying specifically that he won't make voting accessible because African Americans might vote. You really can't get much more explicit than that.
All right. So that's the new segment this week in the
alternate universe.
All right.
Climate change is going to be coming up soon,
we'll
I predict.
See if we can get somebody to do a music bed for that. Let's
something
move
sort
on.
Of like what Twilight Zone or or X-Files or something like that. Yeah.
All right. Websites collecting data.
Yes, websites of major corporations have been collecting data on children. Now, some folks think that's against the law because there does exist a law called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. However, six websites have been caught collecting email addresses and other information from children. That includes McDonald's HappyMeal.com, Nickelodeon's Nick.com, General Mills has two websites that are doing it, Reese'sPuffs.com and TrixWorld.com, SubwayKids.com, and Turner Broadcasting's CartoonNetwork.com have all been accused of encouraging kids to play brand name related games and then providing their friends email addresses or making promotional videos about certain products and then sending them to their friends. In other words, entering their friends' email addresses into the website. Concerned groups have sent a letter to the FTC this week to investigate these companies. Those groups include the Center for Digital Democracy, Public Citizen, the Consumer Federation of America, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. They're asking the FTC to investigate this and other practices, including looking at sites that ask kids to upload their photos or that track children's activities and what they click on online, all violations of the Online Privacy Act for Children.
You know, I always wondered when I see those billboards, 1 in 5 children are approached online by predators, where they get that data. I think I know what they're actually now referring
yes,
to.
Yes, I think I do too. Also this week, the Pew Research Center released a survey where they looked at what has happened to the middle class over the past decade. And what they found is that from 2001 to 2011, the middle class as a whole has shrunk. Medium household income shrank about 5%, and median household net worth, that's your assets minus your debts, that shrank 28% over the decade. And what I want to point out here is the baseline, the base point from which they did their measurement, was the year 2001, and that was long before the housing bubble. So that's not just a lot of the measurements that I've seen recently of a 40% decline in household net worth for the middle class. That's based on the baseline being the year 2007 or 2008, which was just before the bubble burst. This is long before the bubble existed. So what really happened is the housing bubble didn't just burst, it exploded and created a big crater into which the middle class fell.
Nice image. All right, let's move on to international and Norway.
Yeah, Anders Breivik, the right-wing nut job who killed 77 people, I think it was last year when he set off a bomb in downtown Oslo and then took assault weapons and killed a number of teenagers and adults at a liberal youth camp outside Oslo, was sentenced to the maximum of 21 years in prison yesterday for his crime. This is an interesting sentence in a couple of ways. Number one, it was the maximum under Norwegian law for killing 77 people was 21 years in prison, albeit with the option if court feels that he's still a threat to society at the end of that time. And this is a man who was completely unrepentant for his crimes because he feels they're ideologically justified. If he's still a threat at the end of those 21 years, that sentence can be extended. But it's absolutely unimaginable to think he would have gotten a sentence like that in the United States for a similar attack. It really underscores
would have been the death penalty.
Underscores the difference in penal approaches and justice system approaches in Scandinavia versus the United States, where here we are very much focused on punishment and retribution, whereas the approach there is this a person who needs to be removed from society to protect society or not?
Yeah, and rehabilitation too. I mean, I found it kind of interesting that some of the families of the victims expressed satisfaction with the sentence, saying that they didn't believe that the enormity of his crime meant that they had to change their own society and their own very humanitarian way of dealing with criminals by making an exception for him.
In fact, it was a triumph of their system that they didn't have to.
And that if he could be rehabilitated, they would be happy with that. I thought that was a very interesting comments made by them.
The other interesting dynamic about that, the prosecution in that case had been pushed for him to be ruled insane, and the defense had been pushed for him to be ruled sane, which is kind of the opposite of what the dynamic here is sometimes.
Yeah.
The idea, the defense claiming that his political views were insane and the prosecution that they were insane, and they were in fact ruled sane, just terribly, terribly misguided.
All right. And Moscow.
Yeah, Garry Kasparov, the former chess champion turned dissident in Russia, was arrested last week during the sentencing of the punk band Pussy Riot. He was arrested while outside giving interviews and accused by the state of trying to foment a riot himself. He was actually acquitted this week, and yes, that trial did in fact take place within a week of his arrest, which tells you what kind of police state Putin has set up in Russia. But he was acquitted, which is very unusual for dissidents, and the reason he was that because there was a lot of media outside the courtroom that day, there were literally hundreds of different videos and images on the internet that showed that Kasparov was not doing what police claimed he was doing in their reports, and in fact that the timeline wasn't even the same, that he was arrested at least an hour before the police said that he was. And this was notable in that the judge actually believed the online evidence rather than the police reports. So a little bit of a crack in the authoritarian regime there. And Pussy Riot themselves, upon being taken to jail this week, released their new single, Putin Lights Up the Fires of Revolution. If only Katy Perry would record a song like
cover
that.
It.
All right. Events.
Couple of them to talk about this morning. Occupy Northeast Seattle is doing an event in Lake City, a protest at various banks in the Lake City area, starting at 10:30 at the Lake City Bank of America at 125th and 28th Northeast. So if you feel like you're a member of the 99% that might have something to say, tool on up to Lake City this morning. Also this coming Thursday, August the 30th, you may remember that on August 2nd, a grand jury was convened in Seattle to investigate anarchists in the Pacific Northwest. They are going to be having another convening of that grand jury next Thursday, August 30th, and there's going to be a noon rally outside the federal courthouse to support resistors of that grand jury. That's at 700 Stewart Street in downtown Seattle, noon next Thursday.
Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my articles online at mariatomchik.com.